From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
To properly manage the problems between China and the U.S. through constructive dialogue is an important consensus made during the meeting between the Chinese and the U.S. presidents in Washington last month.
That was Liu Kang, a spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, referring to the recent incursion by a U.S. naval destroyer into waters in the South China Sea claimed by China.
But frankly speaking, it doesn't all depend on China. This also requires the U.S. to go ahead in the same direction. The U.S. warship passed into the waters off Zhubijiao, which severely threatened the sovereignty and security of China, as well as the security of the personnel and facilities on the island. It is a severe political provocation to China. The U.S. move has broken international laws, including the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and related Chinese laws.
He called China's sovereignty over the Nansha Islands and the surrounding waters irrefutable and characterized the American move as a provocation. Yang Yuzhen is a spokesperson for China's Ministry of National Defense.
Such action by the U.S. side threatened China's national sovereignty and security, endangered the safety of personnel and facilities on the related islands and the safety of Chinese fishermen's normal operations, and damaged the regional peace and stability. We expressed our resolute opposition and solemn protest. We strongly urge the U.S. side to earnestly respect China's national sovereignty and security concerns, properly cope with divergences to follow the principle of no conflict, mutual trust, win-win cooperation, take concrete measures to correct wrongdoings and prevent such incidents from happening again.
He made those comments following reports that the U.S. Navy had sent the guided missile destroyer USS Lassen within 12 nautical miles of one of China's artificial islands in the South China Sea late Monday. CCTV's Han Bin has more.
Tensions are rising even higher. The U.S. warship Lassen sailed into waters of China's Nansha Islands, also known as the Spratly Islands. China calls it a deliberate provocation. China has been carrying out construction in some of the reefs and islands, including the Jubi Reef, which the USS Lassen sailed close to. The U.S. calls these artificial islands and does not recognize China's territorial rights.
We have said, and we are acting on the basis of saying, that we will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law permits.
China takes the reclamation as natural extensions of insular features and says the U.S. is muddying the waters. Many Chinese believe the foray is meant to show U.S. dominance. For now, Chinese vessels continue their routine patrols of the area.
China is reacting strongly over the U.S. military warship's patrol in the Nansha Islands. It sends a warning to the U.S. about its new military attempts at involvement in the South China Sea disputes. Still, the U.S. says such patrols is what is called freedom of navigation and could become frequent. This new situation presents a new test to the U.S.-China military relations over the troubled waters. Han Bin, CCTV, Beijing.
Teng Jiankun, senior research fellow at the China Institute of International Studies, addressed the question of why China refuses to submit the dispute to international arbitration.
Actually, this is a dispute of the territory claimants, you know, by the countries concerned. For example, China, the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia. This is not an arbitrary, you know, issue, as we all know from the history, especially after the end of World War II. According to the, you know, document, for example, Cairo Declaration, Potsdam Proclamation, and also the surrounding document signed by the Japanese government then, all saying that this these islands, you know, should belong to the Chinese government. And in late 1940s, you know, the Chinese government sent its task force to recover all the islands occupied by Japanese then. So this is actually a history. So you cannot use international law, you know, ratified in 1980s. To, you know, to against their history, you know, several decades ago. This is a reality. We should show our respect to the history, not only to use the, you know, Union Cross to give any, you know, definition to the islands.
The pace of civilian displacement across Syria remains relentless. That, according to the UN's humanitarian affairs chief, Stephen O'Brien, briefing the Security Council Tuesday, where he said the number of Syrian civilians needing protection had increased by 1.2 million so far this year alone.
The failure of the parties to uphold the basic tenets of international humanitarian and human rights law has propelled the Syrian people to levels of tragedy and despair that could barely have been imagined 5 years ago. Mr. President, the pace of displacement in Syria remains relentless. Further displacement is expected to continue at a similar rate unless there is an end to the fighting.
War has raged in Syria since 2011, and thus far, around 250,000 people have been killed. Despite repeated assurances from President Obama, the U.S. State Department, and other top U.S. officials that the U.S. would not put boots on the ground in Syria or Iraq, the U.S. could be set to deploy ground troops in both countries, purportedly to fight the Islamic State. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said that Washington would not hold back from supporting its partners, including with direct action on the ground. RT's Guyan Chichikayan has more.
I will not put American boots on the ground in Syria. I will not pursue an open-ended action like Iraq or Afghanistan.
We are not, obviously, contemplating returning. We're not contemplating putting boots on the ground.
President Obama has been very clear that American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again.
Surprises in U.S. policy statements don't stop there. Washington has maintained for some time that Russia is bombing the wrong people in Syria. John McCain at the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing with Ash Carter pressed him to say that Russia is bombing U.S.-trained rebels. Here's what he got.
I'm asking the question about those that we, some of those we trained and equipped, moderate Syrian forces that are now being bombed by Russia.
With respect to the Title 10 forces that the Department of Defense trains and equips in Syria, they have not come under attack, but we have expressed...
None of the moderate forces, that some of whom we have trained, are come under attack by Russia from the air?
Not in our train and equip program, our Title 10 program, no.
That's fascinating.
Another turnaround, this time on Iran. After years of shunning Iran in the fight against ISIL, U.S. officials are now planning to invite Iran to participate in international talks on Syria. That would be for the first time. It's something that Russia has been suggesting for a long time, and only now U.S. officials are opening up to it. With this, one can imagine more surprises are yet to come.
A dressing down of the U.S. by the world community at the United Nations over Cuba.
We should not confuse reality with wishful thinking or expressions of goodwill. And facts show crystal clear that the economic, commercial, and financial blockade is being fully and completely implemented.
That was Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, at the UN Tuesday after a resolution was passed by the UN General Assembly condemning the U.S. embargo against the island nation. It was passed nearly unanimously by the 193-member body, representing nearly all of humanity, with the U.S., one of only two countries, voting against the resolution. It was the 24th year in a row that the blockade has been criticized at the U.N., and it comes amidst an apparent thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations. After the vote, Cuba's foreign minister held a press conference at the U.N.
It has been a historic record vote of the United Nations General Assembly resolution entitled Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and Financial Blockade Imposed by the United States of America against Cuba, which was adopted by 191 votes in favor, two votes against, and zero abstentions. Almost the entire international community has expressed its support. His vote has been also in support of President Obama's expressed will to engage the U.S. Congress so that the blockade is lifted. This vote is in tune with the feelings of broad sectors of the U.S. society, which support the end of this obsolete policy that has caused so much human and economic damages to the Cuban people, as well as to American citizens themselves. Once again, Cuba reiterates its sincere gratitude for the solidarity and support by all those who voted in favor of this resolution and who have publicly expressed their opposition to the blockade. The blockade has a serious humanitarian dimension. It's a massive, flagrant, and systematic violation of the human rights of all Cubans and affects all Cuban families, including Cubans who reside abroad. It affects the interests of citizens and companies from the U.S. and from third countries. The blockade against Cuba is a unilateral act of the U.S. and should be lifted unilaterally without asking for anything in return. It's only up to the U.S. to adopt the necessary measures to comply with the international law, as President Obama has said, to serve the national interests of the U.S., which will be benefited by the lifting of the blockade to serve the will of the U.S. citizens. The U.S. Congress has not yet approved any of the bills seeking to eliminate some of the blockade measures. However, some legislative initiative has been introduced in Congress, the purposes of which being to reinforce fundamental aspects of the embargo policy and prevent the president from approving new executive measures and implementing the ones that have already been adopted. Cuba has never adopted any discriminatory measure against U.S. companies and business people. Cuba has never set up any obstacle to U.S. trade or investment and never prevented U.S. citizens from traveling to Cuba. The lifting of the blockade will not only serve the interests of the Cuban people, but also the interests of the U.S. people.
This has been a record vote, the one that we have witnessed this morning. 191 votes in favor, 2 against, and no abstentions. Almost in a unanimous way, the international community has expressed its support to the lifting of the blockade. Today's vote has also taken place in support of the policy expressed or announced by President Obama to get involved in a Congress debate with the purpose of the lifting of the blockade. This vote is very much in tune with the feelings of the broadest sectors of the U.S. Society supporting the end of a policy that is obsolete and which has caused considerable human and economic damages to the Cuban people and also causing damages to the U.S. citizens. Once again, I would like to reiterate our sincere gratitude to all those who have expressed their solidarity and support in favor of the already mentioned change of policy, particularly the lifting of the blockade. The blockade policy has a very serious humanitarian dimension. It is a massive, flagrant, and systematic violation of the human rights of all Cubans. It affects all Cuban families and also the Cubans who reside outside our country. It damages the interests of the citizens and companies of the U.S. and also the interests of third countries. Since the blockade against Cuba is a totally unilateral act, this should be lifted unilaterally. It should be abolished unilaterally. and there should be no attempt for Cuba to give anything in return. After the lifting of the blockade, which is damages the natural interests of the U.S., only the U.S., its government and Congress are entitled to adopt the necessary measures to reestablish the compliance with international law. And as President Obama has expressed, to serve the national interests of the U.S. and to all the American citizens. The U.S. Congress has not yet approved after these 10 months, as from December the 17th, any amendment or legislation aimed at eliminating any of the blockade measures. Likewise, some legislative proposals have been introduced in Congress aimed at reinforcing some of the aspects of the blockade or preventing the U.S. president to resort to his executive powers to modify their implementation. Cuba has never applied any discriminatory measures against the companies or business people from the U.S. Cuba has never set up any obstacle against the investments and trade to and from the U.S. And, of course, Cuba does not prevent, rather favors, the visits and travels by American citizens who would enjoy the warm hospitality in our country whenever they are able to exercise their freedom of travel. The lifting of the blockade serves not only the best interests of the Cuban people, but also the will, the desires, and the interests of all the U.S. citizens. Thank you very much.
And on behalf of the United Nations Correspondents Association, thank you for this press conference, and I work for the Italian newspaper Quotidiano Nazionale. My question is this. You get only 3 votes more compared with last year, of 3 small countries, but you don't get the American abstention or the Israeli abstention following the American leadership. Don't you think that this could hurt your process in the relation with the U.S.? And do you think that this is an accusation directly, not to the Congress, but to President Obama, that he's not doing enough?
Yo me siento decepcionado.
I feel disappointed about the U.S. vote this morning. In my speech, I was saying that we are forced to judge by facts, and the facts indicate that as from December the 17th, there has been no significant modification to the implementation of the blockade. In January and September, some measures were introduced, but with an extraordinary limited scope, which are virtually inapplicable if they are not accompanied by further decisions. Several weeks ago, the president of the U.S. extended the validity of the Trade with the Enemy Act, a very old piece of legislation only applicable against Cuba. Much more recently, there have been fines and sanctions imposed against third countries' entities, particularly in Europe, for their relations with Cuba. I have referred to examples, particularly the difficulties imposed on the payments by the telecom company Sprint to initiate direct calls between our two countries. The cancellation of the secure messaging service, SWIFT, in several of its aspects, or the blockade of the financial transactions supporting charter flights because we do not have regular commercial flights between the U.S. and Cuba. And a few hours ago, the government of the U.S. has just voted against the lifting of the blockade. One would expect to find tangible facts in the implementation of the policy announced by the president. Active arrangements within the U.S. Congress in this field, as well as a vote consistent with the international legal obligations of the U.S. in tune with the will of its citizens and the expressions of its president. This has not happened today, and I feel disappointed. Mr. Foreign Minister, what do you think about the explanations of vote given by the U.S. ambassador, the reasons why they voted against the resolution? I feel that the rationale presented by the U.S. to the General Assembly explaining their vote against the resolution happened to be of very low significance. I believe they are not based on the executive capabilities, which are enough on the part of the U.S. president to introduce real modifications to the implementation of the blockade. He is resorting to pretexts related to the content of the draft resolution, which was duly updated since it recognizes the progress achieved in the diplomatic arena in the recent months, and praises the decision of President Obama when he was willing to engage in Congress to lift the blockade. But essentially, this is deeply contradictory and inconsistent with data, with facts, and the new policy that has been announced. As long as the reality is the strict and full implementation of the blockade, the General Assembly of the United Nations, considering its extraterritorial dimension and the violation of international law, the damages caused to third states, and its impact as a massive, flagrant, and systematic violation of human rights, will continue to deal with this matter. I hope that before next autumn, when we will again discuss this issue, the U.S. Congress and government would have taken the necessary steps to dismantle the blockade, just as the taxpayers in this country demand.
Thank you very much, Mr. Foreign Minister. Edith Lutter of the Associated Press. I'd like to follow up on those two questions. Ambassador Goddard specifically mentioned that the U.S. disappointment that the draft resolution did not reflect the spirit of engagement between Presidents Obama and Castro. And he also made the comment that Cuba would be mistaken if it thought that the resolution would do anything to promote the normalization of relations. I wonder how you would specifically respond to those two points. And are there any new meetings planned or any more positive things that are in the works in terms of moving toward normalization? Thank you.
No.
I do not intend to reply to the explanation of vote made by Ambassador Goddard in the afternoon, because I am under the impression that it is not necessary. First and foremost, what needs to be modified is the reality of the implementation of the blockade, not the text of the resolution. We cannot deceive the international community with a resolution that is not truthful or that is far from the tangible facts, the reality of the implementation of the blockade. As we're was repeated by more than 22 speakers with a lot of arguments. What is lacking here is not a spirit of agreement or negotiation in the resolution, but rather tangible facts indicating the modification of the implementation of the blockade or the lifting of the blockade. I strongly believe that the international isolation caused by the policy that is still implemented by the U.S. government, even though when the U.S. president has proclaimed that it would change it, would have necessarily as a consequence a very strong international isolation, as we witnessed today, as we saw in the voting board this morning, as we have heard during the debate, as we have noticed in the reaction, the applauses of all the delegations from different member states. What is wrong here is the implementation and the continuation of the implementation of a blockade which goes against the national interests of the U.S. and against the willingness of all the American citizens. For as long as this continues to happen, the General Assembly should continue to live up to this duty, and Cuba will continue to present this draft resolution. But I found it was very important to listen to the opinions of many ambassadors who spoke here, who thought that the permanent call on the part of the international community for the lifting of the blockade coincides with the opinion of American citizens and also coincides with the will expressed by the President of the United States. Therefore, I believe that during today's debate, a significant aspect has been introduced, that of recognizing that the willingness of the government of the U.S., particularly the president and broad sectors in both houses in the Congress, is to comply with a resolution which only asks for the lifting of the economic, commercial, and financial blockade, to do it right now, to do it without further delay, to do it unconditionally, because this is what is convenient to humankind, to hemispheric relations, to our Americas, because it is convenient to Cuba, to the U.S. and its citizens. Prensa Latina. Prensa Latina. Minister, after this vote, how will Cuba face the circumstances that will come next? The position expressed in Cuba's speech this morning reflects our solid willingness to move towards the improvement of our relations with the U.S., just as was emphasized by the Cuban president, Raúl Castro Ruz, as from December the 17th up to recent days. Here in this place, in the post-2030 summit and afterwards at the general debate, Cuba will continue to do its best to improve its relations with the U.S., to facilitate the change of policy announced by the U.S. president could be implemented. We will do so on the basis of our absolute national independence, looking to our development priorities without any shadows to our sovereignty, and on the basis of sovereign equality and mutual respect. In the speech, recognition is made to the areas of dialogue and cooperation that exist between Cuba and the U.S. We have anticipated our willingness to continue to work in the interest of finding new areas of agreement that would enable us to expand our dialogue and to agree upon beneficial forms of cooperation for the mutual benefit of both peoples. We have received high-level delegations from the U.S., and we will continue to do so. We have very broad contact with all the sectors of the U.S. society in the U.S. as well as in Cuba, and it is our will to favor that. We will continue to invite American citizens to exercise their right to travel to Cuba and to visit our country, which will offer them our hospitality. And we are still confident that the business people from the U.S. and the U.S. companies will benefit from the opportunities offered by the Cuban economy, to the extent that the blockade aspects that prevent them to do so today would be modified. So, as we have usually said, we have completed a very important stage focused on diplomatic issues. There are the proper conditions to move on and to work towards the normalization of bilateral relations, but these will not be normalized as long as the blockade persists. to the extent that there are practical actions to dismantle the blockade, what has been done so far will get some meaning.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar.